Since Cindy Carnahan's periwinkles are still babies out in the planters in front, take time this morning to look in the courtyard at Keith and Frieda Russell's rose garden. These wonderful people have done an extraordinary job out there. And I see Keith at 81 and with a knee replacement out painting the railings. They are marvelous examples of the kinds of volunteers who keep this church so beautiful, and we really appreciate it. Among our numerous visitors this morning are Dr. and Mrs. Bell, whom I know. When I first saw them this morning, I assumed that they had come up to Wichita for some relief from their preaching minister at Mayflower Congregational Church in Oklahoma City. But it turns out that my son is not preaching there this morning, and they have had to settle for a trip here and second best. But please don't tell him I admitted that. I suppose if you had lived in the first century and had had occasion to write serious letters about life to friends living in Rome, sooner or later you would have said something about law. Because if the Greeks were famous for their love of beauty, the Romans were equally famous for their love of law and order. And so when Paul writes to the new small Christian church on the banks of the Tiber, he gets around to that topic. The power of the law, he says, is no empty phrase. You should obey the authorities, not simply because it is the safest thing to do, but because it is the right thing to do. He argues that government was meant to promote public order and well-being, and that when taxes or respect are due, they should be paid. None of that, of course, is particularly surprising. People had said it all before. But what he says next is one of the most startling and provocative things he ever said in his life. People who love their neighbors have obeyed the whole law in regard to their neighbors. All the laws, Paul says, like thou shalt not kill and thou shalt not steal, all the commandments are summed up in this one saying, you are to love your neighbor as you love yourself. If you love someone, you will not do that person wrong. So to love is to obey the whole law. Now listen to it in plain street talk. The law is meant to keep people from harming each other. Love does no harm. So, Paul's argument goes, love is beyond the law, superior to it, and rules are devised for people who have not learned how to love. Now, if there is a judge present, or a trial lawyer, or a sheriff, or a prison guard, what I have just said probably sounds like pious insanity. Does Paul really hope that indomitable goodwill, which is what he means by love, would make law unnecessary? One would have to assume that the goodwill would also be intelligent, to avoid mistakes of ignorance. But love always does more than any set of laws requires it to do. And once in a while, the demands of love will momentarily suspend the demands of the law. For one thing, no law was ever made that did not have some built-in inequities. If all people's circumstances were the same, the law might be more nearly perfect, but they are not. Morality can become so complicated that something beyond the law may be necessary to make sense of it. Time for an example. A Mrs. Bergmeier was taken from the borders of her homeland to a Russian camp in the Ukraine without time even for a goodbye to her husband and her children. Knowing that she was desperately needed at home, believing the family might not survive without her, she tried everything she knew to be released, until at last there were only two viable alternatives. Either she had to be certified as terminally ill, or she had to be pregnant. Mrs. Bergmeier, compelled by love for her family, swallowed her revulsion and asked a guard to make her pregnant. She won her release, and when she got home, the entire family welcomed the new baby because the child had made their reunion possible. What she did is described in one of Joseph Fletcher's books, The Man Who Made the Phrase Situation Ethics Famous. What he meant by that phrase was that there can be no hard and fast rule laid down to cover every contingency in human relationships. That being so, what is right may on occasion have to be determined by circumstances. And if you want a biblical example of that, of situation ethics, I can give you one from the life of Christ. He was passing through a grain field one day on the Sabbath, and when his disciples grew quite hungry, they plucked a few heads of grain, rubbed them to loosen the husks, blew away the chaff, and ate. Technically, what they did was a violation of their own law, where it came under the category of work. They had harvested the grain. And since all work was forbidden on the holy day, Jesus and his friends broke the law. In fact, certain legalistic Pharisees who saw it promptly accused Jesus of being a violator of the law. His response was that human welfare took priority in this case over the law. He reminded the Jewish lawyers that their great King David, along with his soldiers, once illegally ate the sacred bread to keep from starving. The higher law of love suspended temporarily a lower law. People, after all, Jesus said, were not made for the Sabbath. The Sabbath was created for our sake, and it cannot be right to make it work against us. On those occasions when it does, a higher compulsion takes over. So although he had never heard of situation ethics, that is what Jesus was practicing. And I would guess that all of us, are you listening? All of us have practiced it at some time or other. If I had to rush a dying child to the emergency room, and if I saw that driving 50 in an empty 30-mile zone would endanger no one else's life, I would not hesitate a minute. And if a traffic officer saw me, he would probably not only accept my decision, but give me an escort to indicate official sanction. Both of us would know in our hearts that we were obeying a higher law which had temporarily modified a lower one. Now, my beloved friends, I hope you will give me credit for knowing that situation ethics is full of risk and open to all kinds of abuse by selfish and unloving people. But it's an idea which Christ approved, both in words and in action, and the Apostle Paul by clear implication, and we have to deal with it somehow. When I was in high school, 4 or 5 of us won the state one-act play contest with a little 30-minute drama called The Valiant. And I wonder if any of you have ever heard of it. Perhaps the professional actor who read scripture so beautifully and gave me a new word for the Sunday bulletin. Situation ethics had not even been heard of then, but the play illustrates perfectly what that phrase means. The usual law in ethics is that one must tell the truth. But in this play, a man tells a lie and is judged heroic for doing it. I acted several times in that play, including later in college, and I never once saw an audience or anyone in it that failed to applaud the play's whole dramatic point that unselfish goodwill may on occasion reverse the rules by which we need to govern our lives. In the play, a prisoner is about to be executed for some unspecified crime, but he gets a brief reprieve from the governor so that a girl can visit him who thinks he may be her long-lost brother. Although the girl, sent by her mother, does not recognize him after so many years, the audience sees that he recognizes her and that he is faced with either telling the truth and breaking her mother's heart for the rest of her life or telling a lie that will make her last few years happy. With only a few minutes, he decides quickly. He tells the girl that he is not her brother, but that he knew her brother and that her brother died honorably on the field of battle. She is to go home and tell her mother. The play makes it clear that his only motivation for that untruth is love, and that the love is unselfish. Had he been selfish, he might have accepted the consolation of his sister's recognition and forgiveness in the final moments before his death. I remember acting in that play once before an audience of absolute religious legalists, and not a single one of them objected to what the prisoner did. Nor do we object when a doctor decides to distort or ignore the truth about a patient's condition when he and the family have agreed that a higher consideration, the patient's own emotional health, demands it. In such a case, love has altered the norm. There have, for example, always been laws in certain societies and religious groups against suicide. And there's still a general uneasiness about it, perhaps, among all of us. But everybody seems to believe that under some circumstances, it may be not only right, but even noble. True case in point. Four soldiers are in a foxhole when a live grenade drops in with them. One man, knowing in a split second that there is only one sure way to save at least three of them, falls on the grenade and hugs it to his chest. His death is judged heroic, not wicked. The grenade, you must remember, would in all probability not have killed them all. He might have been one who lived. He chose to trade his life for theirs. So what a religious legalist might rule a suicide, and so a violation of divine law becomes magnificent when done from love of others. How does the saying go? No greater love has any human being than to lay down life for a friend. And you know who said it. One of Fletcher's books has this interesting illustration. A doctor has to decide whether to give the last unit of plasma to a young mother of three or to an old Skid Row drunk. The doctor may think his choice is a tragic one between love or justice, but the hard fact is that love must make estimates like this at times. His choice is really one of love and justice, because to prefer the mother in that particular situation is the most loving decision, and therefore it is also the just decision the law cannot help. If you're thinking to yourself right now, and this audience does that this is all tricky and complex business, I join you. The whole idea that love is the only absolute can be twisted in the hands of deceitful people to justify all kinds of purely selfish actions. But many things that are right are risky and can be abused, and no one ever promised us that it would be easy or painless to make this trip. When love is not yet perfect, and for most of us that will be most of the time, we can be grateful for the restraints of law. It only seems right at this moment to remember once more the 13th chapter of Paul's first letter to Corinth, in which the nature of Christian love, agape love, different from what the world calls love, is set forth. But this morning, since you know it so well in its original form, I would like to read a paraphrase that brings it vividly into 1993. You remember how Paul says, "If I speak with the tongues of men and of angels and have not love, I am become as sounding brass or a clanging cymbal." Well, here it is in 20th century terms. If I speak with the precision of a scholar and acquire the subdued elegance of a television announcer and have not love for all people, I am but the staccato voice of a riveting machine or the irritation of a dripping faucet. And if I have the training of a news analyst to predict what will happen tomorrow and understand the Einstein theory and have not a warm love for people in my heart, I will make all kinds of mistakes in human relationships and fail to find the happiness I seek. Love is willing to wait a long time and always searches for evidence of goodness in people. It does not push its way through crowds or break into lines at supermarkets. Love does not care about recognition or committees. It is not distressed by careless words, nor is it depressed when a fellow worker is successful. Love does not rejoice when misfortune comes to a competitor, but rejoices in right, no matter who gets the credit. Does it sound too good to be true? I would think so, except that once in a while, I see that kind of goodwill in action, just often enough to keep me wondering if there is some chance that the kingdom of God, imagined by Christ, might still come. A Jesuit priest wrote the best possible conclusion for this sermon. Listen to it carefully. Someday, after mastering the winds, the waves, the tides, and gravity, we shall harness for God the energies of love. And then, for the second time, in the history of the world, humanity will discover fire.